Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dribble Podcast, your home for basketball in WA, with an inside look at the Perth Wildcats, Perth Lynx, and WA basketball throughout the 2021-2022 seasons. My name is Craig O'Donoghue from the West Australian newspaper, and throughout this year, I'll be joined by a host of guests to provide you with as much insight and entertainment as your basketball brain can handle. In this week's episode, we are lucky enough to be joined by Perth Wildcats import Michael Fraser II, as he provides an insight into the pressures he's lived with in recent weeks. Plus, former Perth Lynx star, current assistant coach and Olympian Nat Burton will join us to discuss her pulsating debut for the Warwick Senators in NBL 1 West on Thursday. But first, the NBL season is going down to the wire. We know the Wildcats will extend their streak to 36 years in the finals if they win one more game. Those matches are against Illawarra and Southeast Melbourne. They'll also play finals if they lose those games and Melbourne beats Tasmania. So there's a lot going on and it's going to be tight. What we know is wins aren't easy because the lower teams are causing upsets. So will we be back next week talking finals, or will we be talking about the end of the streak? Time will tell. But let's get into it straight away with our first guest. He's proven to be one of the nicest blokes anyone could ever meet, and he's been through a hell of a lot more in the last few months than any of us could have imagined, yet he came out the other side with 19 points against Cairns on Saturday. Michael Fraser II, welcome to the Dribble Podcast.
Thanks, Craig. Thanks for having me on.
Now, before I ask you anything, I really want to acknowledge that you could have easily said no to this interview. It would have been easy for you to lay low, play out the season, and just not talk about anything because it's been hard enough for you as it is. So I think it's really worth acknowledging that you're here. So let's talk about the past few weeks and give you a chance to tell your story. Everyone knows what happened. The club went looking for John Brown to add a different sort of a look to the team. How did you get through it, given you had no control over what was happening?
Well, yeah, I think it's no secret that it was a difficult situation, but, you know, to be honest, given how bad things had panned out during the season, up to the time that they wanted to bring John in, with the lack of clarity, you know, around how I would be used, actually, I was prepared to cut ties and start looking for other opportunities that were around. So, I mean, I'm a pretty mentally tough guy, and, you know, obviously, management or coaching staff wanted to make a move, and that's really out of my control. And, you know, there wasn't a whole lot that I could do to control that. I obviously didn't want to leave my teammates, but, you know, like I said, obviously neither sides were happy with the way that it had been going up to that point. So, you know, I was ready to investigate other opportunities.
So let's walk people through what happened then. We know the club was really upfront with you throughout the process, which was really important. How did you learn that your position was in jeopardy and they were looking to go to John Brown? Was it a meeting? Was it a phone call? How did they manage to convince you that it was all happening and but it was okay for you?
Well, there were rumors and, you know, rumblings before the club came to me. Then once they told me in a meeting that they were bringing John in, I was preparing to leave. The uncertainty that transpired after that, the meeting that I had with Scott and Danny was frustrating, not only for me, but also for my teammates who were trying to, you know, support me. And at the same time, like, John's coming in and they want to welcome him into the squad in the middle of a season where we're trying to win games. So that was definitely an awkward position, but I think me and John handled it well. I don't think that's a secret. You know, it wasn't an easy thing to do, but we handled it like professionals.
There was shock initially when the club decided against signing an import centre. That was what everyone was expecting. They went with yourself and Matt Hodgson, and everyone was expecting at the time that there would be a different mix when they went. And most people looked at it and went, you look like a really good player, but they've got a lot of people who would play your role in the team. Could you understand why they got to this point of the season and went, we're actually missing a piece of the puzzle and we've got a lot of other pieces that look a hell of a lot the same?
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, I understand why they wanted to do what they wanted to do. But I also feel that if I was used like I've been used my whole career, the need for a change may not have existed. But, you know, I think things have a funny way of working their stuff out in the end. And I guess the club and I are exactly where we're meant to be. So I'm prepared mentally and physically to, you know, help the team win and be used however the team decides to use me from here.
So we saw a bit of that on the weekend. You were used in a way which clearly suited you. How has your role changed then since this has all gone down? Because it's clear that you were doing different things and being asked to do different things in that Cairns game to what we'd seen earlier on in the season.
Well, honestly, Craig, like that's how I play. That wasn't a one-off game. Like that's what I'm used to. That's what I expect of myself. Now it's a bit different because obviously all this stuff has happened and, you know, given the current situation, like we need to win two games regardless of what any other team does. Like I want to help this team win two more games. So, you know, I'm going out with that mentality to be in attack mode. And I think before it was a lot of just trying to be the glue guy and try and, you know, get in where I fit in. And that obviously wasn't working out for either side because neither party was happy. But I think the way that I played last game, I think that game was brewing for a long time. But, you know, I got the opportunity that would allow me to show people what I can do, allow me to show, you know, the coaching staff what I can do in management. And I honestly feel like my teammates, they see it every day in training. I do that all the time in training. So, you know, it wasn't a surprise to me. I know it wasn't a surprise to them, but maybe to like fans that haven't seen it all year, you know, I'm pretty sure they were happy to see that. But I mean, like I said, I expect that from myself. So, you know, I want to get better. I think I can play better. There were things that I did in the game that I made mistakes and I can clean up those mistakes. So I'm always looking to improve and try and be better next game.
So you talk about how you've played in the past, like your 3-point shooting stats as a professional across, I mean, even I suppose as a college player across the board are extraordinary. Like they say you barely miss when you look at the over years of data. Were you just waiting for opportunities to really get those shots in the rotation and find the opportunity on the floor to showcase your skills?
Absolutely. It's crazy because you know, like I said in training, like I do that all the time. Like I've been shooting the ball extremely well in training the entire year, and you know when the games come, the opportunities don't translate. The same opportunities that I have in practice, playing my natural position, and then you know going into the games and it's completely flipped, or you know I'm not being used as much, not getting the same opportunities, the same looks, like it can't translate. So a lot of that stuff is out of my control. And I was, you know, that comes with a lot of frustration in itself. But at the time we were winning and that's what I came here to do. I came here to help the team win. So, you know, I was putting my needs on the back burner. But in order for this team to be the best that we can possibly be, like, I have to be the best version of myself. And I think people got to see a little snippet of that last game.
So once you were told that your position was likely to go to John, like you were in a really interesting position because a lot of athletes, and we've seen this in the NBA, they go into disruption mode straight away if they're forced to hang around somewhere where they're unhappy and things aren't working out. But you went the opposite way and tried to make it work. Like, why did you stay instead of just going, well, he's here in the country, I'm not going to hang around for 2 weeks, I'll just disappear? Like, why did you decide to try to remain part of the group in case you were required back?
Well, I was prepared to leave. And, you know, my agent was already starting to look at other opportunities for me. But I stayed largely because it's not in my DNA to quit. And, you know, I wasn't raised that way. So I think that's mainly it. And plus, you know, the club wasn't releasing me or they hadn't released me officially because there was still uncertainty around if they were going to be able to get the John deal done. You know, so it wasn't like they, you know, cut ties right then and there, because had they done that, then I would have been out. But it was like kind of that gray area. And, you know, I really didn't want to leave my guys. You know, like I've grown really close to this group of guys, one of the best teams that I've been on. And actually, like me and Bryce have gotten like pretty close. So there was a emotional aspect too, that I still felt that attachment. regardless of what was going on outside of that, like I'm fortunate to be on a team with a great group of guys outside of basketball. So I think that kind of helped me in the whole situation, just helping me to keep my mental good on top of all the work I do, you know, on myself outside of that, like, you know, the reading and seeking advice from my peers and just always striving to be a better human, because the man that I am outside of basketball is bigger than the game. It's bigger than who I am as a player. So I think that's really just a testament of to all the self-work that I've done over my entire career, just to be a better human.
And who did you turn to for help, to who to talk to? Because I'd imagine you can't really turn to the coach. You can't really turn to the CEO or anyone else. Florida's a long way away. Like, who are you turning to vent to, or to just look for some support when you're on the other side of the country to your family and friends, and you know that you might not be here in a week's time?
Well, I mean, honestly, like, it wasn't – it was more so – Bryce was huge. Vic was huge. Kevin White, Jesse Nordo. I mean, I could go down the line, like Jack Purchase, Kyle, Matt. Like, I mean, these guys like really had my back this entire time. So, like I said, like it wasn't a great situation to be a part of, but having those guys, like knowing that they supported me through it all, That shows that they're so special, you know, and I'm extremely fortunate to be able to come in and work with these guys every day, you know. So, I mean, I know Scott had alluded to it in his press conference about, you know, having a partner that's dating somebody else. Well, I'm happy that I'm dating my partner again. We'll just leave it at that.
And the even weirder part about the whole thing was that you and John Brown became mates while I was here. The photo of you and John Brown embracing after the team won, and you're both on the bench. And like, I know you're both from Florida. You're a couple of years apart in age, and I don't think you ever crossed paths in the past. But how did you become so close so quickly with the guy who had the spot that you were both competing for was the same? Like, it must have been really weird, but you became friends.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't even think we were competing for a spot. It wasn't even that. Like, I think the spot was his. Had they been able to get the deal done, you know, it would have been his. So, like I said, like earlier, that stuff was out of my control, and it wasn't his fault. You know, like, he was a cool dude, and we're from the same state, and we're both far away from home. So I think that definitely helped. It was an awkward situation, but I think we made it less awkward for everyone, or maybe more awkward for some guys, because, you know, they're like, why are they getting along so well? But I mean, I think it's just a testament of the type of men that me and John are, the way we went about the situation.
So has the entire saga given you a different outlook on professional sport and how ruthless it is at the moment?
I don't think it has. You know, if, you know, the coaching staff and management feels like there needs to be a change made, then, you know, that's up to them. But I've been a professional for more than this year, you know, and I've seen things, and I understand, like, the business is the business. So you got to come in and do your job every day and focus on the things you can control, and the things that you can't worry about them.
You certainly have seen it in the past. I was having a look at your history before we were chatting today. And if we go back to 2015, you were undrafted and then signed with the Lakers on August 25, 2015. You spent 57 days with them before you got waived. And 11 days later, you signed with their G League affiliate, the Defenders. You spent 78 days with them and then got traded to Iowa. That contract had lasted 50 days. And then you were signed by the Fort Wayne Mad Ants, which is the greatest name in the history of mankind, I reckon, the Fort Wayne Mad Ants. So from August 25, 2015 to March 11, 2016, you trained with the Lakers and played with three clubs. It just shows that in your industry, there's no security whatsoever, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that was my first kind of experience as a pro. You know, it was my first year out of school. So that definitely got my mindset to where I think it helped get me to where it is now, to, you know, along with a lot of other things, people support me. And like I said, having peers that I can bounce things off of and seek advice from. But that I think everything is always equipping you for something greater. You know, I always try and have that mindset. And it's no different from this situation that I've just gone through. You know, I always try and look at the positives and see what I can gain from it. See how can I get better from it and, you know, move on.
So everyone speaks about your positive attitude and it seems to be a real part of your career and your life. Is it a family thing? Is that something that's been instilled in you from the family always, or is it a professional thing that someone else has drawn into you?
Well, I would probably say it comes a lot from, you know, the way I was raised, like not to quit, very high on respect and discipline, work ethic. And I think all of those things have allowed me to get to where I am today and, you know, has allowed me to experience the things that I've experienced and be on the things that I've been a part of. And ultimately, the success that I've had has all been in large part of those things and my upbringing and, you know, the way that you carry yourself and the way that you treat people and, you know, how hard you work and all of those things. So, I mean, my value system as a man is bigger than who I am as a player. And that's largely in part to my family, my dad. You know, he raised me pretty well, I would say. So yeah, a lot of that credit just goes to him, my parents.
So tell me a bit more about the family. I know you're one of many, many children. I think there's six of you, is my memory. Your dad's Michael Frazier the first, so that's where Michael Frazier the second comes from. Tell me all about what your upbringing was like, family life, living back in America.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there's six of us. I'm the eldest, so I was always the role model, you know, good and bad. If I made a mistake, my dad, you know, had to make an example out of me for the younger ones. And also, you know, I tried to make a standard of the type of human beings that, you know, we want to represent the Frazier family. And that's like I said, like a large part of that is due to the way my dad raised me. Like when you go through adversity, when life gets tough, like you don't quit, you know, you keep going. Because you can't stop the sun from shining. Bryce told me that actually. But, you know, my dad always said, like, no matter what happens, like, this too shall pass, you know? And you just got to keep your head, down, keep working hard. I think every man is going to be tested at some point in his life. And when he's tested, you know, when he goes through that adversity, that's when his real character is going to show. You know, so I wouldn't want a specific situation or somebody else to define the type of man that I am, regardless of what it is. Everybody has their challenges in life and, you know, it can't rain forever and you just got to stay strong, you know, and I think that's what I've done my entire life, really, because this ain't the first time I've been through adversity. Like I tore my quad at 23 years old, and doctors told me that I had to retire. So, like, I'm playing with house money if I was going to listen to them, you know. So I go out there and I give everything that I have every single day. I work my tail off every day. And that's the reason why I can have the success that I've had. Like, nobody's ever given me anything. People have always doubted me. I've always had people doubt me and, you know, second guessing me. So this is nothing new. You know, I'm equipped for this. This is who I am as a man. And the type of player that I am, like, my resume speaks for itself. When people go look that up, it speaks for itself. Like, I don't play with a chip on my shoulder. Like, people were saying, oh, we want to see the chip. Like, it ain't no chip. That's how I play. That's how I know how to play. It's the only way I know how to play. That's me as a player, you know? So, I mean, I think coaches and media were talking about lack of confidence. It wasn't never that. You know, I've come to the conclusion through working from it and really, you know, looking myself in the mirror, I think that was more lack of certainty in my role and my minutes, you know, and my opportunities than it was a confidence issue. So, I mean, given all of this, man, like, I'm excited to still be here. And I'm excited to go chase this championship, you know, because that's what I came here to do. But I want to be the Michael Frazier that I know I can be for my teammates and for the fans that supported me through all this, because I was getting a lot of fan love when it was looking like I was going to be out of here. And then once the deal with John fell through, I mean, people were just flooding my DMs with positive messages and positive energy. And, you know, I always try and keep that stuff in perspective, but that just shows me like how much Red Army is like some of the best fans that I've ever been able to play in front of, you know, and that's why I'm still so excited to be a part of this club, regardless of what happened. You know, I'm very happy to be here and continue to work towards that goal that I came here with.
Well, the crowd certainly showed their voice for you when you ran out before the games, the past two games, when your name was read out, the cheering was quite clear. You ended up in the crowd twice against Cairns and you had a bounce about the way you played, I thought, which was fantastic. And this is a good time for me to mention the Dribble Podcast MVP Awards, which we have on this podcaster. Michael, you were in those votes from the game against Cairns. I went one vote in the game against Cairns to Matt Hodgson, two votes to Michael, and three votes to Bryce Cotton for his 22 points and 10 assists. Although I think you'll find Bryce is a bit annoyed he wasn't credited with an 11th assist for a pass late in the game. And against Adelaide, it was one vote to Todd Blanchfield, two votes to Vic Law, and three votes to Matt Hodgson. So Bryce Cotton is now on 56 votes with an eight-point gap on Vic Law in second place. As you mentioned your record. It's been amazing when you look at your experience, like two G League grand finals for one championship. In one of those games in the deciding contest, Michael had 24 points, 9 rebounds, 6 assists, 2 steals and a block. Also got on court for the Houston Rockets in the 2020 NBA Final Series against LeBron James and the Lakers. You've had a lot of success over the years. What do you put this success down to from a team perspective, your ability to fit into any sort of environment?
Well, I think for one, it's been my work ethic. My discipline, my determination, my hunger to get better as a player, my hunger to get better as a person, you know, my respect for the game, my mental toughness. I mean, there's a lot of things that I could credit to that, but also, you know, having the right people in my ear, having the right people supporting me in my corner, and then opportunity. You know, sometimes you just need opportunity and they don't always come when you want them to. But, you know, my dad always told me that the cream gonna rise to the top. And when your opportunity presents itself, you got to be ready, you know, so you stay ready so you don't have to get ready. And that's what I've done this entire year. So, you know, like I said, I'll go back to it. That game, that wasn't a surprise to me. Like, that's, I expect that, you know, I practice like that. So, I mean, that was a long time coming.
And you mentioned your injuries before. Like, that quad was horrendous, everything I've read about mm-hmm. it. And you had a broken arm mm-hmm. as well, which was pretty ordinary also. Like, you have had some injuries this year as well with the hamstring and the knee, and mm-hmm. I think it was cork was the other one. Like, you haven't had it easy with your life, have you, from an injury perspective? You've copped some pretty big ones.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I think all that adversity just – If you use it the right way, it can just help you become a better person and, you know, make you stronger. Because every time that I've gone through something in my life, I always come out on the other side, you know, a better man, a better player. And this has been no different. So, yeah, the injuries this year have been frustrating. But I also think that, you know, trying to trust the medical staff and, you know, I'm not always the easiest guy to deal with when it comes to certain injuries, but there's been some miscommunication sometimes on, you know, many restrictions and things like that. And, you know, when I can play versus when I can't, you know, that's definitely been frustrating, but, you know, Dan and those guys, they're great. So, I mean, yeah, it is what it is.
Are you off restrictions this week? Obviously, we don't know whether Vic Law is going to be available at this point. It's 2:25 p.m. on Monday we're recording this. There's no news on Vic with his ankle. Do you know if you're fully able to play this week, or are you still on some sort of restriction?
Well, I hope I'm not. I'm ready to go.
And tell me, how have you found WA while you've been over here? I know you and I bumped into each other at the airport when you were heading to Tasmania shortly after Christmas. And I said, what did you do for Christmas Day? And you said, I went to the beach. It was awesome. I thought it was 43 degrees. I'm not sure you're not at the beach, but it feels like you've settled in really, really well into this state and are enjoying the opportunity to be here.
Yes, I am. I'm enjoying it so much. And my time here has been great outside of basketball. I love Perth. I love WA. I love the beaches. The people are super nice. The restaurants are good. It's just a good quality of life. The weather's beautiful. My neighbors are nice. So it's been a grand experience outside of basketball. I wouldn't trade that for the world.
Well, hopefully you can get the good experiences for the rest of the season on the court as well as off the court. How's the team feeling heading into really important two games this week to try to lock away that finals berth?
Yeah, I think we're ready. I think we're locked in. I think this is the most locked in that we have to be because our season's on the line right now. We have to approach every day in practice like that, with that type of seriousness, and just go out there and execute, you know, what Scott's asking us to do. And I think, you know, it'll all work out. It'll work itself out.
Brent, look, thank you so much for coming on. Like, as I said at the top, the easiest thing in the world for you would have been to avoid interviews. But I think you've shown an amazing insight into your character all season with the way we've watched you. And I think this is another shining example for how people can handle tough times. So I really appreciate you coming on because it's not a simple situation to be in.
Yeah, Craig, I appreciate you having me on, man. It was a good interview. I appreciate you giving me the platform to give my side of the story because I think a lot of people were just perceiving it from, you know, whatever they were being fed during the time, and I didn't really have a chance to discuss how I was feeling about it. I think things could get misconstrued in that type of situation. So thank you for giving me that opportunity.
Michael Fraser II, everybody. We hope he continues to have a fantastic year and hopefully all the dreams that you've had coming to Australia can now come true. So good luck for the rest of the season.
Thanks, Greg.
Well, the Easter weekend saw NBL 1 West enter the second round, and it was also the time where a number of Perth Lynx players competed for the first time since losing the WNBL Grand Final to Melbourne. But of all the performances from Lynx personnel, it was the effort of their assistant coach that stood out. Nat Burton changed out of the coaching uniform, put on the Warwick Senators gear, and proceeded to have 31 points, 11 rebounds, 3 assists, 4 steals, and 1 block. That's one hell of a game, and I'm pleased to say she's on the line with us now. Nat Burton, welcome to the Dribble Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Now, did you see that performance coming?
Not in the slightest. It's been a while since I've played, obviously not playing, first time not playing WNBL. So first break and longest break I've had since I got back from college in 2012. So I actually was a little bit nervous about how I would play and whether I'd still be able to do the things I used to be able to do. But that performance shocked me.
So you spent 36 minutes on court, which is a hell of a long time. You must be in bloody good nick. So how did you combine the challenge of coaching with preparing for a season where you know you're going to have to spend that long on court?
I think that I'm just from playing for so long, I like to stay active. And so I'm always, you know, keeping fit and I'm always doing something. And then preseason started. And while I was also still coaching, I knew what was coming and I still wanted to prepare. I think after having such a long career, I couldn't like just go into this season just being like, yeah, whatever. Like that's just not me. And I knew that I wouldn't be giving my best if I was doing that. So I made sure that I got as ready as I could, but I got COVID a couple of weeks ago. So that threw a spanner in the works. And then flying back and forth from Melbourne with the Lynx for the last couple of weeks, it's been a bit of a jumpy and rough pre-season and start, but somehow it worked.
So you were part of the furniture at Perry Lakes, really. It was where you grew up and where you had such success. Why the move to Warwick at this point of your life?
Yeah, it was a big move for me, really, having started there when I was under 12s, when I first started playing basketball, all the way through now being 33. It was really big. And I think the biggest thing for me was I wanted to make sure that if I was still playing, I was enjoying it. I didn't feel the need to reach amazing heights. I've achieved a lot in my career, and I know that when I was achieving those things, I was always on the hunt for it, and quite often that left me feeling more empty than fulfilled. But as I've come towards the end of my career, I've realized that the reason I play is because I enjoy it. Otherwise, it's not worth everything, all the effort that I give in, and all the sacrifices I make. So really, it was about, okay, I want to have fun. Where can I have that? And when I realized that I was only staying at Hawks just out of because I just didn't think that I would ever leave, didn't allow myself to ever leave, I was like, well, that's not on. That's not fun. And in the work that I'm doing with young athletes, I want to make sure that I can tell them to go and find fun when they're playing and to hold on to that. And I couldn't tell them to do that if I wasn't doing that myself. So that was probably the biggest part of that for me, was just, where can I have fun and finding it?
You mentioned something, the empty instead of being fulfilled. Like it's sport's hard. Like it's a really hard thing to do, especially professionally. We saw Katie Ebsery retire in the offseason and talk about how she wished she'd been kinder to herself and that she was put so much pressure on herself at times. You achieved so much. Like, was it always, you never felt good enough, even though there was always something, another level to go to? Was that the problem, that if you achieve one thing, it's like, well, I haven't achieved the next?
I think it's a fine line between perfectionism and striving for excellence. And I was always, and I know a lot of athletes are on that hunt for the next thing, you know. I can only talk about me. I never felt good enough. And I was always, okay, if I make the Olympics, then maybe I'll feel good enough. And so, you know, I would put everything into that, and I achieved that, and I felt the same, maybe even more empty. It didn't give me what I was searching for, because I was searching for something outside of myself. I was trying to feel good enough based on these external achievements. And I think every athlete has that, a little bit of that, you know, that gives us a drive. But I know that mine bordered on, you know, unhealthy, and that fed into me not being happy in basketball and not really having that fulfillment. So when I flicked it to, okay, like I can still achieve things and have fun and enjoy it, well, now I'm okay with making mistakes. I'm more okay with who I am, and my identity isn't as tied to basketball as much as it has been. And I find that now I'm enjoying basketball a lot more because I flipped that mindset.
So was that a decision you made to retire because of that, or did you make that decision about changing things because you retired and were able to reflect? Like you could still be playing WNBL, but you've chosen to go a different path. Where did that decision come in?
That mindset shift happened maybe 4 years ago. So I got to the point where I was playing basketball because I loved it and I enjoyed it. And I knew that my life was great without basketball. Like I didn't need basketball anymore. I didn't need to play to feel whole anymore. So I could make that decision in that space around, well, my life with basketball is great. So I'm going to make sure my life, if basketball's still in it, is also great. And I could make a decision there that was, okay, now I'm playing for fun and I enjoy it. And so I think my decision to retire was more around, like, I'm okay without it. Is there a great situation where I'm willing to give up the energy that I now want to put into my business and the work that I do with other athletes? That's what my decision was made off of, really.
And when we look at one of the features of the last round was the efforts of the Lynx girls coming back into the level, second tier level, I suppose we could refer to it as. And Alex Sharp had 20 points and 18 rebounds. Emma Clark, 31 and 15. Emma Gandini, 21 and 9. Then there's 14 points and 8 rebounds from Mackenzie Clint-Toycard. And Mia Sadie had 23 points, 12 rebounds and 5 assists. Like, they are some big numbers from them. Like, you must have been really thrilled they were able to push the disappointment of the previous weekend behind them and still be able to go out and perform, because that's hard to do.
It is. And it's been a long season for everyone involved, but let alone these players who their minutes, you know, they weren't the starting five, so their minutes weren't as big as the starting fives were. So they've put in the same work all season long, training times. They've given up the same hourly commitment as everyone else in the team. And I think that they were just hungry to get out there and play. And I know that that's a lot of them. They just want to play. Again, that's why we play, is because we enjoy the game side of things. And they've been given the opportunity to just go out there and use the skills that they've been building up throughout the whole season, playing against your Sammies, your Marinas, your Jackies in trainings, and playing with them and learning from them. It's like a release. So I have no doubt that they all enjoyed themselves tremendously just going out there on the weekend. And it's so good, those numbers. It's really good to see what these players are capable of, because they definitely worked hard for it.
Now, we hear all the time, regardless of any sport, that a lot of people look at players who are playing at the second tier and go, oh, they're good enough to play at the elite level. And everyone just assumes that you can step up from one to the other. And I think cricket's a really good example of that, where everyone remembers Adam Voges, who went on and had scored 130 on debut, yet the next 14 Australian batsmen after him averaged 22 in their first innings at international level. So it just shows there's a big difference between second tier and the elite level. I think Emma Gandini saw that in the first couple of games she played, where she was like, whoa, this is a different world all of a sudden. But by the end of the season, she was a different player. How big is the gap? Like, but if you're a player now thinking, I'm playing NBL One West, how big is the gap to get to being even just part of a squad like the Lynx?
It's hard to describe the gap. I don't think it's massive. It's definitely there, and it's there in small ways, like the speed of the game, passes that you'd be able to pass in NBL One West wouldn't necessarily get there in WNBL. The strength of players is bigger. Remember, you're now in WNBL, it's almost full-time professional, and whereas in NBL One West, it's most of the team has day jobs, 9 to 5s, and then they go to training, and then so the gap is there. But honestly, when you look across all of the NBL One leagues across Australia, all the Opals players are in there, minus a few who are at WNBA and whatnot. So it's not, the gap's not big enough that people don't want to play in the league. The girls that do still play in the league, they use it for different reasons. They want to keep that game fitness. They enjoy playing still, and they want to make sure that they're ready for the next thing, whatever it is, Opals commitments or the next WNBL season. So I think, yes, a gap, but not tremendous. And I think it's getting smaller and smaller, and the more players that, like your Emma Gandinis, who get to go to the WNBL level and experience it and then take those skills back to NBL One level, we're just like making that gap smaller and smaller.
So we've seen a big focus from the Lynx on bringing in WA talent. What's your advice for the young ones who want to be the next Emma Clark or Taya Burrows, or the mature player who wants to be Emma Gandini? Like, what do they need to do this season, do you feel, to give themselves a chance of being noticed and being ready for if they get the opportunity to attend a camp or a training session where you want to impress? What do you need to do now to be ready for September?
Yeah, it's definitely your two training sessions a week that NBL One requires and your games isn't going to cut it. So I think if you go down to Bendad on any given day during the week, there's always NBL One players there who get that, who are hungry for the next level, and so they're doing that extra work. So that's a given. But I think it's about understanding what your strengths are and what your role can be on a team. So at a WNBL tryouts, the coaches. They have their starting five. Well, they have their imports. They have their 20-point scorers per game. What they're looking for is those people that do the little things, that work their butts off, that can fill that role. And I think players need to start to understand, because I never understood. I thought best players get picked, but it's not necessarily the case. It's how can we build a team to win a championship? And what missing piece do we need to fill right now with these junior players, or has there been someone with crazy stats who we want to give a go and see how they go at this next level? It's those kinds of understanding. But obviously these players are already working hard because they're trying to reach the next level. So it's just being ready for any opportunity that comes.
You mentioned the strengths there before. I loved watching you play because you were different to everyone else who you're competing with. In your last year at the Lynx, you were the average height of every other starting center in the league, but you were 16 kilos lighter than every other than the average throughout the comp. Yet you played in a team and you led that team to the top of the table, and only the fixture really cost you the chance to play for a championship. So you defied the convention. And by focusing on your own strengths, how did you do that going into games? I reckon a lot of coaches would have been saying, put on some weight, go do more gym work, do this, do that. But your athleticism was one of your features. So what do players need to do to focus on their strengths instead of hearing that nagging voice in their ear saying, be different?
It took me a long time to realize that because, like, when I went to college, that's what they were doing. I'd have to sit in the weight room after every session and drink 2 protein shakes. Every meal I was at with coaches was about, get more on your plate, like, keep eating, got to bulk up. And I bought into that while I was at college, and I could never be what that coach wanted me to be. But that took me away from the strengths, my speed, my agility. I can still hit hard despite not being having the kilos on me that some of the other bigger players do. So I think when an athlete can look within and look at, okay, what do I first of all get joy doing on the court, because I love to run, and that aligns with my agility. What am I good at, and can I notice my strengths and admit them and then work on them, and how do I bring them into a game, and how do I make sure I bring that into any team and hold on to that despite the noise. So I bought into a lot of noise from media and people writing articles. Why is she in the team? She's not strong enough or whatever. So I think when you can block that out as much as possible, I don't think you can ever 100% block it out, but when you can start to block it out and go back into, okay, what are my strengths and how do I give them? What are the actions that I can do on the court that are going to display these strengths to play well, to help the team?
So are you able to send that message from a coaching perspective? Because that's where it gets hard, because everyone wants to improve the weaker areas of a player while enhancing the positives. And I suppose Damien Martin's the classic example over his career, the best defensive player we've ever seen. Not a great shooter, but everyone was able to go, you're such a good defensive player, we can hone in on that and you can become the greatest of all time. Are you able to, as a coach, remind people and stay in that window of strengths, rather than getting sucked in to improve some weaknesses?
Yeah, I try to. And I really try to have those conversations as much as possible. And I think it's really important that we do, as coaches, have that and start to get that messaging across. Obviously, you need to work on your weak points. Like, we know that. But I think we, as athletes, as people in general, are too good at knowing what we're not good at and focusing on that and finding all the ways that we fell short. And that can be incredibly debilitating because it takes our focus and our attention away from the things we did well. And in a society where, you know, especially for basketball, you're good if you can score points, you know, and we hear that messaging constantly all the way up from juniors through the media, everywhere. So a lot of the work that I do with athletes that I had to do with myself was taking away from that scoring mindset, taking away from the things that you don't think you did good enough. And yes, focusing on, what did you do that was good? And how can you continue to bring those strengths to every game that you play? And I think the coaches have the biggest responsibility in making sure that messaging is getting through to athletes.
Hey, what, you're bloody good at. You're bloody good at winning. 3 SBL championships, a title in Germany, bronze medal at the World Cup, been to an Olympics. Like, your team success and what you're able to filter in from your skills into helping teams was amazing. What do you look back on with the most fondness now out of all the success you've had at different levels? Because success is success, whether it's SBL or going to the Olympics. Like, you're still part of a group that means something to you. Which of those groups that you look back on with the most enjoyment now?
Yeah, I think this past experience with the Lynx was really highlighted to me, championships are rare. Some players go through their entire career without winning a championship, and I haven't won one at WNBL. I really wanted to win my first one as a coach and assistant coach, but there's maybe more time for that in the future. But, when I look back at those rare and amazing championships that are special to me, I mean, it wasn't a championship, but the bronze medal at the World Championships in Turkey in 2014, that was probably the most exhilarating I've ever felt from basketball. Any bronze medal usually feels quite beautiful because you win your last game, and we were playing against Turkey and in Turkey, so the home team, and we scored like the first 19 points of the game, and I just remember that stadium being dead quiet because they were just silenced in shock, and that was fantastic. So that's probably the biggest one that I look back on.
Now, tell me about your life off field now. You mentioned a couple of times you work with a lot of athletes and you're helping with a lot of people. What's your job?
My job is all sorts of things. I do other coaching, so individual type coaching with young athletes and group sessions. But my real passion is my business, which is called Enriched Athletes, and I'm a mentor. So I work one-on-one with athletes, and it's conversations about their mindsets and about the things that came up for them in a game and tools for them to try and new ideas and new concepts that I've used towards the end of my career that I've found helped me that I've read about and understood. So that's my real, real passion. I also do a lot of like mindset training for other athletes, so like group sessions, and I run like an athlete wellbeing program at Junior Association in WA, and that's just trying to get people to understand that we can start to look after this side of athletes that we've been forgetting, and that I certainly didn't have, you know, the mindset, the mental health, the work-life sport balance, all of that well-being type stuff that we just forget about when we focus so much on our performance on the court, but is also a massive part of that influences our performance on the court and influences every other area of our life. So that was a lot. I can't really say that I have one type of job, but it keeps me busy, and I love it. I really think that my whole career, yes, I achieved these amazing things, but I definitely feel like, and I'm using that now, it was all setting me up to be able to help other athletes who are going through the same thing and walking the same pathways.
You only have to look at Marina Mabry, I suppose, who missed that free throw in game two and then came out and had to recover in 3 days from a mindset perspective to get back on court, refocus and play. Like there's examples right in front of people of the elite level who have had the lowest of lows and then have to get back to try to achieve the highest of highs, isn't it? It's not easy.
Yeah, sport can be really hard. And at the end of the day, people say it's just a game, and it is a game. But in the moment on the court, in front of everyone, when you're exposed, it feels like life or death. And so there's a lot of slippery slopes in sport, a lot of areas that we have to be careful of, that we can fall into the traps if we're not looking after our mindsets and our mental health. So I know that Marina works with a performance mindset coach herself. So the top athletes are understanding that this is a side of us as humans that we need to look after, that can help our performance on the court, yes, but can also just help us in all general life. Because coming back to, yes, sport, basketball is a game, sport is just sport, but it is bigger, and it reaches a heck of a lot more than what we think it does. So that it makes sense that we have to look after our mindsets and ourselves as we're dealing with it and living it.
And, of course, right now the focus for you is on playing as opposed to all the other stuff. It is an Easter weekend where we're talking, so you have hopefully been able to enjoy life rather than working the entire time. And if you want to watch an Australian Olympian in action, head down to Warwick Stadium on Friday night. It's Nat Burton's Warwick Senators up against the Eastern Suns. Tip-off is at 6:30 p.m. anyone who's played sport at any level knows that game two is harder than game one. How's the body feeling a couple of days out right now from the last game? Do you feel human again, or are you still walking around going, I played some sport the other day?
I feel human. I feel good. We've got a couple of training sessions this week before the next one. So, yeah, it'll be good to keep on rolling with the season. I've been enjoying it so far.
Well, good luck. Hopefully things keep going really well for you, because you've been an absolute star and a great role model for everyone in WA basketball. So thank you for joining us on the Dribble Podcast.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for the Dribble Podcast this week. Remember, keep logging on to thewest.com.au for all of your basketball news and pick up your copy off the West Australian. Thanks to Samantha Rogers for her production work. Thank you to Michael Fraser II and Nat Burton for their time. We'll be back next week for another episode of the Dribble Podcast.